When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome to Friday afternoon's late lunch on LMFM Radio. Great to have you with us on the show. Wasn't it a lovely morning? It was in this neck of the woods anyway. Clear blue sky, sunshine. I think the day is changing as we go on, but it was really lovely this morning. A little cooler, but nice type of dry weather and lots of people out and about walking and getting their little tasks and things done today. Anyway, it's still changeable for the next few days. I was just looking at Audrey on the weather there and it's getting colder as well. Welcome to the show. Hopefully we'll warm the cockles of your heart on late lunch this afternoon. Coming up on the show, David Sheehan's with us later on, previewing the weekend in sport. I'm out in the garden. I am indeed in Rosie May's wonderful garden. And guess what? On Daffodil Day, it's all about daffodils. It sure is. Jim Gaffigan brings us our comedy. Dr. Dan McCartney is with us in a wee while. The importance of vitamin D to good health. And it can't be overstated, Dan says, and he's talking to us on the show after two. We have your TV theme competition. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, don't forget the usual numbers. 086 1800 658 by WhatsApp or text. You'll need that for the competition anyway. 086 1800 658 by WhatsApp or text. I'm delighted to chat to my first guest today because, in her own words, back in 2005, along with three cats, a five-year-old daughter, Chris, her husband, and herself up sticks and moved from the safety and security of a three-bedroom semi-detached home in the UK to a hunk of dereliction in rural County Limerick. Really? Rebecca Palmer, welcome to Late Lunch.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. Was it really a hunk of dereliction?
Yeah, it was. The house hadn't been lived in for 40 years, unless you count the occasional bovine visitor. The farmer used to take some cattle in sometimes to warm them up in front of the fire. But yeah, the house had been empty for over 40 years, so it was pretty bad.
And you are now 18, going on 19 years there at this stage. And my God, have you shed blood, sweat and tears in terms of transforming the house itself and the lovely garden. You are, of course, the woman behind the frugal Irish homestead. Are you now totally sustainable, self-sufficient?
I'm completely self-sufficient. I'm completely sustainable. Everything we do is as sustainable as we can possibly make it. Self-sufficiency is a funny expression because obviously I like to call it paddling my own canoe rather than self-sufficiency because obviously it doesn't matter how much I grow, the insurance, you know, the people at FBD still want the money for the insurance, you know?
Yes.
And also wheat and things like that, any sort of grains and pulses, really it's not realistically feasible on the side of a hill in County Limerick to actually grow that sort of thing for the whole family. So, you know, I'm actually most of the food we eat is pretty damn close to being self-sufficient, really.
Oh, I look at what you do and my God, I'm in awe. I'm a little amateur gardener myself. I have a greenhouse in a tunnel and I love growing for the table and I'm dabbling at the flowers now a wee bit. But when I look at you, my oh my, you grow all your own veg, you have fruit. I'm just running through what I see you have as well. Poultry, you make your own bread, you preserve. Is it true? Have you grapes?
Yeah, we've both our big polytunnels have got grapevines. I mean, I think I got about, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think it was about 16 litres of grape juice last autumn from just one tunnel.
Fantastic.
You know, there's about 30 pounds, or was it 30 kilos? It's a hell of a lot of grapes, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's juice. You don't dabble at the wine, no?
I have done, but it was so bad. I decided that I decided that actually it was, and this is an interesting sort of point about the whole self-sufficiency thing is I planted the grapes and I thought I was going to make wine. I made wine. It was terrible. But I also realised that I don't actually drink that much wine.
Okay.
You know, so what would be better would be to turn those grapes into something that is actually a useful product for the family. So
yes.
Grape juice and grape jelly. I mean, I don't make a lot of jams and jellies, but because we just don't eat a lot. But the grape juice is a really useful thing, and you can spread it through the year. It's a great thing to add in the winter, and that's more useful to us than a few bottles of wine, you know?
Yeah, and when you talk about winter and the different seasons, of course, this is the big sowing time now, as I know as a gardener, and then you have a glut through the summer months into early autumn. What about winter and the hungry spring? How do you manage there? Do you just store, preserve, that type of thing, yeah?
Yeah, I think actually a lot of people who are getting into homesteading now think of the Hungry Gap as advertised by our American cousins across the water who have like 2 feet of snow as we speak.
Yeah.
Here in Ireland, to be perfectly honest, you actually can have some reasonable amount of stuff in the garden pretty much all year round. I mean, right now I've still got lots of leeks, parsnips, kale, there's greens in the tunnel. I should have Brussels sprouts, except I had 9 cows in my veg garden the other day. you know, there's still red cabbages standing in the garden. You know, there's stuff to eat in the garden all year round here in Ireland, really. So I also put up a lot of stuff. I do a bit of freezing. I do a lot of canning, dehydrating. You know, I started off making lots of jam, chutneys and relishes and things, but again, realised we don't eat that much. So, you know, I'd rather have them in a way that's more usable.
Mm. What about your bread making? Is it sourdough?
I do sourdough. I do ordinary bread. I grind my own wheat. I basically make all sorts. I make my sort of daily bread. I do like making sourdough, but it's a couple of days' commitment every loaf, and I don't always have time for it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, listen, it is, and you must be committed to it for sure. The poultry, obviously, you have eggs from them. I take it you use the meat as well. And do you have more than chickens? Did I see you have ducks as well?
No, we did have geese.
Right, geese, wasn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we had geese for many years, actually. It's not been that long since we got rid of, well, since the last one got eaten by a mink, to be honest. But The problem I had with geese is that I don't like them.
And generally they don't like people either.
Well, no, the thing was our geese absolutely loved my husband.
Did
but they absolutely hated everybody else. I mean, seriously, to the point that he actually came home from somewhere one day and found me sitting in the trailer in the yard because it's surrounded by the geese.
You know what I think?
I'd gone outside to do something and the door had shut behind me, so the dog was shut in the house. And I was surrounded by geese and just hopped in the trailer and just stood there until my husband came.
Oh my God, that's a first for me.
Yeah.
But you know what I'm thinking here, Rebecca? Every man should have a goose.
Yeah, I think that's what he thinks too. He keeps on sort of saying, shall we get some more? And I'm like, no, not really.
But obviously with the poultry, the hens and that, they have eggs, you do eat them. Do you barter? I did read somewhere you used to barter, you know, your poultry or eggs or that for meat and that. Does that still happen?
Yes, yeah, I do. I do barter. I do a lot I barter a lot of all sorts, really.
Yeah.
Skills as well. You know, a lot of my sewing skills. I do sewing as well as a sort of cash earner, and I do that for bartering too. So, for example, I don't have any apple trees. I've planted a few over the years, but they've just not particularly thrived. And I do get a few, but not enough for preserving needs. So I have a good neighbour who I do quite a lot of sort of mending and repairing and putting new zips in jeans and what have you. And in exchange, I get, you know, 3 or 4 big boxes of apples every year. And I also trade out poultry. I have a couple, because, of course, in Ireland, it's not legal to sell poultry that you butcher yourself. In fact, it's not legal to butcher it yourself either.
Mm.
But I do have 1 or 2 friends, close friends, who will take a few bits and bobs from me in exchange for things, you know.
Yeah, really good. I was going to mention the sewing, all right. I see you have an Easter camp coming up, sewing classes for children. Children and sewing, you know, it's a thing that our grannies did, as you know, in Ireland. It's sort of a skill that seemed to be lost in a middle generation. Are children do they take to it? Do they like it? Is, you know, is there a graph for it?
Yeah, I mean, before COVID, I was teaching about 60 children a week.
Really?
I used to have 4 evening classes and then one sort of Saturday camp every Saturday. Now, obviously, with the lockdowns, everything got shut down. And to be honest, I'm just sort of rebuilding that again. But yeah, they can't get enough of it. And, you know, it is interesting to see their sort of interest in it and their enthusiasm. They don't know. It's quite interesting, actually, because I take them from age 8, and between 8 and 12, they absolutely love it. And then quite a few of them, when they go to senior school, suddenly decide it's not cool anymore.
Mm.
But there's an odd one that's obviously fixated who will still come. But it's interesting, and they are really enthusiastic. But their learning skill is no different to the adults. You know, some of them are more confident, some of them are not. Some of them are more dexterous, some of them are not. You know, it seems to be fairly similar to the adults, really.
And when they have the skill established between 8 and 12, they'll have it in their lifetime. They can always come back to it and pick it up in the future.
Yeah, well, I've been doing the classes in County Limerick now for about 14 or 15 years. Mm. And I'm now getting children who perhaps were 12 or 13 coming to me as adults.
Yes.
You know, who were sewing with me, they'll come just to double check something before they have a go. You know, we know that you know, so will you show us what to do? So that's lovely, because I know that they've picked up that skill with me and they've kept it up, you know, in the back of their minds.
Yes. Teach them and they will sew, for sure. What about the whole concept of a homestead? You have quite a large garden with the house there as well. You know, it is a commitment, there's no doubt about that. You've got to work at this to make it work.
Yeah. You have. And I mean, what people see now at the Frugal Irish Homestead is the sort of culmination of 20 years of work, really. Prior to that, I was a sort of an urban homesteader, as most people would call it now. I don't think that existed back then. But, you know, I had an urban garden, but we grew quite a lot of veg. Now, we couldn't keep any livestock or anything, but we used to go out foraging for blackberries, and I made bread. I made all my own bread even then. You know, it's a good commitment, but we sort of played at it in the urban setting before deciding, to go full, you know, full on
self-sufficient.
And you know what? We've only had, I think, one holiday as a family in the last 19 years, really. So now I'm not a great traveller, so it doesn't really bother me. My husband likes to travel, so he's off out and about quite a lot, and I stay home. But you know, we've had the one holiday altogether because it's difficult. You've got to choose who comes to look after the place with care, you know.
Yes, the only thing I'll say to you is, and I don't mean this in any derogatory way, your lifestyle and what you've achieved and what you've established there is more than any holiday, may I say. More than.
Yeah. You know. Well, I like to think that I'm very lucky. I hate people saying to me that I am lucky, because I've kind of made my own luck to some extent. You know, we had to make some very difficult decisions about not going to work 9 to 5 and earning a living, you know. And, you know, we had to sort of decide to step away from that. So it's not necessarily luck exactly. But I do feel a certain amount of luck when I look at my view. And I'm sure if you've looked on the website, you've seen what my view is like where I live. And it's you know, I look out the window and think, wow, you know, I'm lucky to live here and I'm lucky to be able to live this lifestyle. And it is not like a 9-to-5 lifestyle. So there are benefits, even if you can't go on holiday. There are so many benefits.
Oh, for sure. Is it for everyone? It can't be. It's not practical that your life and the way you live would be for everybody.
No, it's not practical to do the full-on like we do, but I very much encourage everyone to have a little go at some elements. I think it's good to have skills, like to be able to make. I mean, look at the lockdowns. You know, everybody got into making bread. You know, being able to do basic things for yourself is useful, and it's empowering, and it makes you feel it's a great feeling of achievement when you make something, whether it's a pan of jam because you went for a walk and picked some blackberries, or whether it's some bread that you decided to bake, or you know, or even something more complex. But it's a great feeling, so I do encourage people to have a little go, and it's brilliant for the sustainability, you know, removing packaging, growing some greens on your windowsill, sprouting some seeds. You know, these things can all be done with zero waste, zero packaging.
Absolutely.
You know? So I sort of encourage people to have a go at those things. They don't have to have a full 2-acre small holding. You know?
I agree with you. You don't have to go the full Monty, but there are things we can do ourselves. Because when you're totally dependent on going to the local supermarket, if something happens in the supply chain or the chain to the supermarket someday, you'll be left with nothing. Whereas if you can make the jam, make the bread, have the ingredients in store, grow a little of your own, well, you're not 100% dependent and you have that independence.
And another thing that I think is a big part of homesteading that I think is very much overlooked is it's about managing your resources. Sometimes, when we first started, you know, we'd eat a salad or make a roast dinner with potatoes and carrots or whatever and say, oh yes, we produce this. But that's really the tip of the iceberg. It's managing, you know, getting your sort of, I don't know, 60 or 100 pounds of potatoes in the autumn and then managing them through till spring in their different forms. So dehydrating some so they can be different meals, and slices for, you know, dehydrated, and canning some for the hungry gap. And, you know, all the different things, doing all these different things with the individual items is actually really important.
Absolutely. I just listened to you and I think people are listening today and admiring you and everything that you've done. It's simply wonderful. Look, I have to leave it there today. I could talk to you for the whole afternoon, but I have other things to do. But look, thank you for joining me, giving us a feel of your life at the Frugal Irish Homestead. Check this wonderful lady out, Rebecca Palmer. It's been great chatting to you.
Thank you very much. And you, Jerry.
Take care
of
yourself. Bye-bye.
Great. I love TV.
We watch TV.
TV Themes with Jerry Kelly on The Late Lunch.
Remember that TV movie we saw?
Pretty scary music, isn't it, Louise?
But I love it.
Yeah, don't say a thing. Don't say a thing because...
it's great music.
Yeah, great show. Great show as well. What's the name of that TV show that we've just played the theme from? 086 1800 658 by WhatsApp or text. Daffodil Day today, Louise.
Yeah.
Daffodil Day, the big day for the Irish Cancer Society. If you're out and about, do support them. They do wonderful, wonderful work. And there's daffs fresh and pins and everything all over the place. And they'll be around tomorrow, I think, again. It's great. And a little bit later on in the show, I'm taking a walk with Rosie May in our wonderful gardens. And it's all about daffodils today on Your Late Lunch. I'm coming back to a topic now that may have slipped down the pecking order in the last year or so, but it is so important. What am I talking about? The vitamin D deficiency in the Irish population and how important it is to have your vitamin D at the correct level to help on a range of issues, but especially the COVID matter, which, you know, is still hanging around. No matter, you mightn't think it is, but it is certainly out there still. I'm delighted to welcome my next guest back to the show. He's a very good friend of ours. We haven't spoken in a while. It's Dr. Dan McCartney, and he's Programme Director in Human Nutrition and Dietetics at Technical University Dublin. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Jerry, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm really good. It's great to hear your voice again, Dan. It really, really is. And you know what? As I said there, it is appropriate because, you know, at this time of the year, we're still in springtime. Vitamin D is firmly in the picture. Dan, you might tell us first, why is there such a large percentage of the population so deficient? What's the reason?
Well, there's probably a few different reasons for that, actually, Jerry. I mean, we're all indoors more now than we used to be, and that is across the board in our leisure time activities and also in our work. But there's a few other things that have shifted secularly over the last sort of few decades. So, for example, we have a much greater ethnic mix now in Ireland and other northern European countries where there are more people with dark skin living at these northerly latitudes. And unfortunately, dark skin makes vitamin D less efficiently at those lower sunlight intensities. So that's a factor. The population's getting older as well. We're all aging. Nothing we can do about that. And I suppose apart from being inside all the time, we do use sunblock as well when we go out. And sunblock, that tends to block out about 99% of the valuable sun rays that create this vitamin D in skin. And then the final factor here is that we're all becoming more overweight and obese. And unfortunately, when you're overweight or obese, it requires that you take extra vitamin D orally to achieve the same increase in blood levels. So people who have overweight or obesity need to supplement with about 2 to 3 times the amount orally to achieve that same bump upwards in blood levels.
What's an adequate level of vitamin D in the blood, and how do I know if I have sufficient or insufficient?
That's the big question, Jerry. There's a bit of contention about this, and it really depends which endpoint you're talking about in terms of clinical outcome. So while many people would feel that a level of 50 nanomoles per litre would be adequate for bone health, there are many others who argue that you need to go above that. You need to achieve a blood level of about 75 to achieve best outcomes for bone. But when we get into the area of immunological status and how the immune system deals with these viruses like SARS-CoV-2, you're really talking about levels over 75 nanomoles per litre for the immune system to operate optimally to eradicate those viruses. And that isn't easy to achieve. There are many, many people below that level. Just to give you some context on this, there's about 50% of Irish adults at this time of year that have vitamin D levels less than 50 coming into early spring. Mm. And there's another sort of threshold that they talk about at 30 nanomoles per litre. That's what we refer to as profound deficiency. Mm. At that level, your bone health is affected, your immunological health, and lots of other things are affected. And there's about 15 to 20% of the population that fall into that category. So they have potentially serious problems coming down the line.
So without testing for it, in a general sense, this is known. So what do we need to do on a daily basis? What do we need to take to ensure that we have adequate levels and will maintain those levels?
Well, the simple answer here is supplementation. So the question is really about dosage and what dosage of supplement you can take. At the moment, we're told to take 10 or 15 microgram doses, but we believe that doses higher than that are required. And the reason we think that is because there's a very interesting research study that's just been published over the last few months. And that took the data from 49 different European studies and pooled them together. And they came to the conclusion that in order to get 95% of European adults over that 50 nanomole per litre threshold, you really need to be taking 25 micrograms per day, which is 1,000 international units. So we would say that that's a more realistic intake for people that are wanting to achieve that 50 nanomole per litre threshold. That's where the research evidence is pointing us now. And indeed, as I say, for people that are carrying risk factors for deficiency, like darker skin at northern latitudes, or who are a little bit older, because again, older skin makes vitamin D less efficiently, or for people perhaps who have darker skin and are living at northerly latitudes, that's a thing that needs to be factored in. So 25 to 50 micrograms per day is probably a more appropriate dose for them.
And would you take that year round, Dan?
Yeah, this is the other thing that I suppose the Department of Health guidance on this tells us that we should supplement between October, late October and mid-March. But we believe that the evidence doesn't really stack up there. In other words, while in the past people used to go out and get lots of vitamin D synthesis in their skin during the summer months, that doesn't really happen anymore. So while our status improves a little bit over summer and vitamin D levels tend to go up a little bit because we're getting some sun exposure, there's still a very significant proportion of the population that remain deficient irrespective of season. So we think that people should be supplementing all the year round with those 25 microgram doses, or at least that's what the research data, the best research data are telling us now.
What about children, Dan? From what age should children supplement with vitamin D?
Yeah, the guidelines there have evolved over the last number of years. So actually children, now these are at lower doses of 5 or 10 micrograms per day, depending on age. But children are advised to supplement at all ages. So, I mean, that's a part, I suppose, from infants who are being bottle fed because the vitamin D is the formula. But all other infants and children are advised now to supplement with either 5 or 10 micrograms per day. It's lower doses than adults, but still helpful to them in terms of these sort of health outcomes that we were talking about, infection and things like that, as well as bone health.
Is it available in a liquid form? Because you know children yourself, even the smallest tablet at times, it's a devil to get it into them, Dan.
Yeah, there are some liquid supplements. There are drops, for example, and those are the ones that are typically given to babies who are breastfeeding, for example. They just give the supplement by drops. So those are available, yeah.
Pregnant women, Dan?
Yeah, no problem for pregnancy. EFSA, the European Food Safety Authority, didn't make any distinction when they were giving guidance around supplementation for pregnant women. So in other words, there's no increased risk of toxicity for women to take vitamin D. And indeed, our own Department of Health here say that 15 micrograms per day is the appropriate dose for women who are pregnant, and that they should take that at all times, irrespective of the time of year. So they should take that every day.
Now, if you go to a chemist shop and say, lots of people take cod liver oil, for example, and you'll see with added vitamin D, and indeed other over-the-counter stuff you can get with added vitamin D in it, are you better just going for the vitamin D on its own, pure vitamin D, rather than having it included in something else?
Yeah, I mean, in some regards, it's possibly a benefit to be taking both. So typically, if you were taking a cod liver oil supplement at the advised intake per day or at the advised dosage, you would probably get either 5 or 10 micrograms from that dose. And if you were then taking a 25 microgram individual supplement as vitamin D on its own, that would still only bring you to about 35 micrograms per day. And that's perfectly safe. There's no problem with that. So the question is, would it do you any benefit or any additional benefit? It might, because at this time of year, typically we see blood levels at around 40 to 50 nanomoles per litre. So if you're able to get upwards by taking a supplement that gives you a little bit extra, that drags you up into the low 50s or the 60s, that's a benefit.
Mm. A listener there wants to know, she takes vitamin D3, 2000 IU daily. Is that okay?
Yeah, 2000 IU is the same as 50 micrograms. So the conversion factor there is 40. So you see it described in both ways on these supplements, either international units, 2000, as I say, equates to 50 micrograms per day, or micrograms per day. So that's fine. That's within the safe, yes, tolerable upper limits that are quoted by FSAI and the European Food Safety Authority.
You mentioned different aspects of our health that vitamin D can help with, but that's really concerning when you read seven times if you don't have the adequate levels of vitamin D, less than 30 in your blood, you're seven times more likely to be admitted to ICU and 25 times more likely to die if you contract COVID.
Yeah, this is the real key message, I suppose, to get across to people. This was a study that we did with John Fall's team in Connolly Hospital in Blanchardstown. One of our undergraduate students had done this. And it's a really interesting study. We divided the population into the vaccinated and the unvaccinated. So in the unvaccinated people, now remember, about half of all of the COVID population that are in our Irish hospitals today are unvaccinated people, even though they make up a fairly small proportion of the population. Mm. So these unvaccinated people, when we looked at their vitamin D levels and we adjusted for all of the other things that might explain this, so we adjusted for obesity, ethnicity, age, male sex, pre-existing disease like diabetes, all of those were taken out of the equation, if you like. And even after that was done, the people that had blood levels less than 30 nanomoles per litre, so that profound deficiency that, as I said earlier, affects about 15 to 20% of the population, if they were below that 30 nanomole per litre threshold, as opposed to over 50 nanomoles per litre, the risk, as you've identified there, of going to ICU was 7 times greater, and the risk of death was 25 times. So this isn't percent, this is 25 times greater than the people who had levels over 50. So that's a really important thing. There's something that we can do about this to protect ourselves, and it's really important that people are aware of that.
Absolutely. Just to finish, I take it you've been involved in a number of research studies in this country, and it ties in with it, major European studies as well. You'd like to see the Department of Health push this a little harder?
Yeah, the Department of Health have moved on this, and they've increased the supplement dosage guidelines over the last year or so. And while that's very welcome and it's a positive step in the right direction, we believe that the guidelines should incrementally go further up to this 25 microgram per day dosage for adults in Ireland, because that's where the research data are pointing us. That study, as I say, that study that was published last year, just the end of last year, where they pulled the data from nearly 50 studies across Europe. That's what those research data are telling us, that 25 micrograms or 1,000 international units per day is the number that we need to be supplementing with.
Dan, fantastic as usual. Great to talk to you again. And thanks for disseminating that wonderful advice to our listeners on Late Lunch this afternoon. We won't leave it as long again. Thank you and have a nice weekend.
Thanks very much, Jay. Great.
Take care of yourself. Bye. That's Dr. Dan McCartney there, Programme Director in Human Nutrition and Dietetics at Technical University Dublin. He's a brilliant guy. There's a really strong case there for the vitamin D, for sure, when you listen to Dan all year round. You're at Late Lunch on LMFM Radio this Friday afternoon. We're going to have a laugh and a half next. We certainly are, because coming up in a few moments, Jim Gaffigan brings us a comedy on Friday.
Knock, knock. Who's there? That's how it works. It's called...
Comedy?
Comedy.
Comedy, comedy.
Comedy, sir.
Comedy.
Comedy.
Classic comedy.
Classic comedy.
On the Late Lunch.
I love comedy.
Recently, I was invited to a surprise birthday party. It was a surprise birthday party for a dog. That's right. I have friends that are mentally ill. I went. It was in my apartment building, and I needed the material. And to be fair, the dog was surprised. Didn't suspect a thing. Dog didn't know it was his birthday. The dog didn't know it had a birthday. The dog wasn't sure why people were in the apartment. It was the dog's third birthday, which in dog years doesn't matter. Someone made that up, and we just went along with it. Oh, 1 year equals 7 for doggies? Okay. When I see a dog, I'll do math. That's not fulfilling some dog need. You know, there's not a dog sitting in a bar right now going, I'm not 3, I'm 21. I can legally drink. That's not how dogs keep track of time. If you have a dog, you know they don't keep track of time. You've left your home, forgotten something, walked back in, only to be greeted by your dog like you've just returned from war.
They're back! It's a miracle! They're back after I don't know how long, because I'm a dog! These poor dogs!
We just attach these points of view on these poor dogs. Like dog is man's best friend. How desperate are humans?
We're best friends, right?
Dog's like, well, aren't we different species?
But we're best friends forever.
You know, you locked me in the house all day. With nothing but a bowl of water. You'd think you'd let your best friend sit on the couch. We're best friends. Now put on this fireman's outfit. We're going to do a photo shoot for Instagram. You know, sometimes when you sleep, I think about eating your face. But I get it. I love dogs, too. I love animals. We all have the friend that announces they love animals in a way that implies the rest of us are drowning kittens. Yeah, but I love animals. Well, that's a pretty exclusive group of just you and anyone who's not a serial killer. Yeah, but I just get along with animals better. Or humans don't like you. I did have an opportunity to go on a safari, which was unbelievable. It was breathtaking how bad the Wi-Fi was. I went on a safari, which is just a fancy word for animal stalking. Because that's what you do on a safari. You follow animals and watch them. You're like, beautiful.
The brilliant Mr. Jim Gaffigan. Louise, we ever had a dog birthday party?
No, and he never said whether he got cake.
I think he's right about one thing. God help people who have parties for their dogs, birthday parties. And the name is Saint.
Would you say there's many of them?
Oh, there's a growing number. I'm really worried for humanity, as Mr. Gaffigan says there. I think of my late father, who loved dogs and had every manner of dog in his life. A birthday party? I'll tell you one thing, I can see the man now. He's turning in his grave, even listening to that there. The name is St. Christopher. A birthday party for a dog. Cop yourselves on, will you, for the love of St.
Might have got a doggy bag.
Make sure you have a doggy bag to pick up your poos. And when you pick them up, I just want to mention this to the person who picked up the doggy poo. Louise, yes, picked it up. And just dropped it in my garden.
Oh,
in my
no.
front garden. In the bag and all. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for doing that. You're a real kind person. You did well in picking up the dog poo in the bag, but take it home with you. Or put it in one of the dog poo bins along the road, would you? Instead of leaving it in my front
and
garden.
And it definitely, because you know the way some people, if they pick it up and they leave it, and then on the way back, they'll pick it up and bring it home.
Oh, no.
You know, if they're going on, it's definitely...
I watched for 2 days just to make sure, would anyone claim it? So I picked it up and put it in my bin and it's gone now at this stage.
That's
but in
really
the name
awful.
Of God, why would you pick it up and then drop the bag into my garden? You know, why would you do that? Like, come on, for the love of sake. And I saw another flip today with a dog and him combing the dog out in the green beside us, combing the hair out of the dog. The hair was flying everywhere. Now, it'll be the only thing I'll tell you about that. Yeah, the hair is flying everywhere. He wouldn't do it in his own back garden, the gobdaw. He wouldn't do it in his own back garden and gather up the hair like I do when I'd comb Messi or that. The only thing I'll tell you about, there is a slight benefit in this with the hair from the dog. Birds will pick it up and use it to line their nests.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so there maybe is. Maybe I've been too critical there on that one. But if you pick up the poo, put it in a bin near or bring it home, which, would you just do me that favour and forget about dog birthday parties in the name of God, they're dogs, not humans, as Mr. Gaffigan says there. Anyway, I must stop giving out Alicia Keys.
I was just thinking of a suitable name for a sitcom for you there in my head.
Anyway, Alicia Keys is on the way with Girl on Fire. And after Alicia, I'm heading to Rosie May's wonderful garden for a daffodil soiree. Stay with us on Late Lunch. It is Daffodil Day and no better place to be than with Rosie May in a wonderful garden. Yes, the insomniac gardener. She's getting a little sleep this weather with the days getting longer, that's for sure. And it is daffodils, well, for the most part, all the way today. Look at this.
Yeah, I brought these out for you, seeing as you did mention you wanted to talk about daffodils. Now, these are one of my favourite varieties. This is just, it's Narcissus, it's Jetfire, and it's got a lovely little kind of a two-tone combo of yellow and orange. And I love them because they're small. They're not, you're not looking at kind of miles and miles of foliage for ages. And then this little beauty over here, that's Tête-à-Tête, but it's a double one. Which again is a miniature variety. I think it's called boucle or something like that. But isn't that just so sweet?
Do you know what I love? And okay. I've learned already something from you here today. I have them in pots at home, but they're the standard large daffodil. Yes. And you know, when you get breezy weather and that, they're blooming lovely, but they sort of fall over. But these two varieties here are totally suited to pots.
They absolutely are. And you can see the slightly smaller one up there. That's
a baby.
A baby. That's Tête-à-Tête. In fact, I actually just got those, ready, potted up in a pot in a garden centre and just popped them in temporarily. And what I'll do is I'll take those out and I'll plant them in the ground afterwards. But you can see they are smaller than the Jetfire, but they're still both really, really just a nice size. Like that's probably what, about a foot tall maximum. Yeah. And then you're just not looking at acres and acres of foliage. Like you'll just see over here in the beds as well. That's all tête-à-tête. And the tête-à-tête, what I love about those is then, say, I have a lot of catmint planted there. And as the catmint and the hardy geraniums grow up, they cover the dying foliage. So you don't have to start chopping them or twisting them or doing any of that malarkey. So that's why I just love them.
They're absolutely beautiful. How many bulbs would you put in each of those pots there?
I think I've about 15 and you can layer them. Now, I'm not going to leave those in those pots because I think long term, I mean, they'll survive for a couple of years in a pot, but everything has its limit in a pot and you have to feed them and you have to water them and you have to do all sorts of things. Now, they're just actually buckets. Look, there's it's a metal bucket and then that's a little waste paper metal bin from IKEA, actually, that I drilled holes in. And once I take those out, I'm actually going to plant those in the meadow.
Okay.
So I don't waste them.
Yeah.
And, and it's great to plant them now because in autumn, I often go in with my fork and I'm like, oh, Jeannie, and you splice something in half. And so at least this way now I know where there are no daffodils. I'll show you when we get up there.
And if you were leaving them in a container, you'll get a year or two out of them with that number of bulbs in a pot of that size. And then after that, really, you need to plant again.
Yeah, well, it's just they get congested, you see. And then there's also a lack of nutrients to feed them. Mm. Now, letting the foliage die back, that's the mantra. And I've been trying to get around it for years because it always says, let the foliage die back. And if you don't, then the following year, they haven't had enough food to feed the bulb and then they come up blind or they won't flower the following year. And that's why I started looking into shorter daffodils because, the 2 foot high daffodils, I do have them, I'll show them to you, but they're now in an area where they can just let them die back. They're planted in amongst lots of shrubs and they can do the do down there and, let them die back naturally. But these ones are on display and, as I say, they'll go into the meadow afterwards.
Yeah. So. Absolutely lovely. Let's walk on this daffodil day. And as you say, there are more of them here. Look through the beds as we walk up here as well, with a lot more besides.
Absolutely. Even this little bit of sunshine has really encouraged all the new growth you see there on the catmint. And you can just see, there's all the little tips on hydrangeas and just lots and lots of growth.
I see it because I remember from the last day I was here and the bleakness of it. And you can just see it, if I could say now all, peeping and ready to burst forth.
Absolutely. There are so many plants now in the ground. Half the time, sure, I forget them. And then when they peek up, they're a nice surprise. Like I'm just looking up there. Do you see the lovely purple?
Oh,
that's
beautiful.
A snake's head fritillaria. And then beautiful shrub there. Do you see with the orange?
Oh, yes.
That's Edgeworthia chrysantha red dragon. And it's related to in January, February, the Daphnes.
Yes.
It's kind of the same family.
Yeah.
But it's the paper bush shrub and it's lovely. They were used to make banknotes, I think, in Japan years and years ago, or quality paper, so it's really interesting. But there's more little tête-à-tête daffodils now in those two pots.
In the pots. They're lovely. You have them dotted round beautifully and they just, catch the eye as you gaze round the beds as well. And I have to mention our friends overhead. Oh. There's an absolute beano going on here because the crows are building and building like mad. Do you reckon, just looking up for a moment at the trees there, are there more nests in the trees year on year?
Well, certainly they've extended their housing estate because before when we moved in, it was just here. But now they're around the corner there at the front of the house, so there's probably about 80 nests in total up there. I remember we counted it 1 year and, look, I love them, but it is a bit of a curse because they drop so many twigs. I probably spend about a week over the period of the building period going around with wheelbarrows and they give out heck to me because you can tell that I'm taking their building material. I just put it on the ditch line so they can access it. Look at that lad just
there's a fella just
there.
After flying in to pick up some of those twigs that you put there. They're marvellous. I love them and the noise, the cacophony of sound there is amazing.
Now, I'm just going to show you some. That's a lovely thing there. That's called Summer Snowflake. People think it's a giant snowdrop. It's not. It's Lycodium. And then, do you see this little one here?
Yes.
Isn't that lovely?
Gorgeous.
And then the ones here, they're white. I love white daffodils. And now I know I don't, there's so much to learn about daffodils and I don't know a lot about daffodils, but I just know what I like. And that's Thalia, T-H-A-L-I-A. And I can highly recommend that one. Again, it's not too tall. So you're, and the foliage is kind of strappy as opposed to that, you know, kind of very elaborate. Do you see the bigger foliage on that yellow one over there? But Thalia is absolutely lovely. And then this is another one of my favourites. It's called Bridal Crown. And Bridal Crown is highly scented. And look, it's just gorgeous. It's kind of a like a double daffodil.
It is.
I'll bring
is.
There's lots more up there.
We oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We're going to walk on and see them. Yeah. And just in general sense, when we are walking on, daffodil season is now a more lengthy season, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It starts when? When will you see the first of the daffs? And then when is the end of the season? Just for listeners.
Well, actually, the tete-a-tete daffodils came out in early February because they're established. Now, It's interesting because sometimes I say, oh, I'd love to fill up this with a few more. And then I plant some in the autumn. Any of the ones that you plant, say, like last autumn, they're later because obviously they're not established. But the ones that are in the ground and have been fed and, you know, kind of sank back into the ground and they're waiting to come up, they spring up much earlier. So I'd say February. But then the daffodil season goes right on until May. I mean, you have so many. There's lots of lovely gardens that you can visit in the UK and they have daffodils like for months and months and months. And in fact, anybody who is interested in daffodils, there's a wonderful daffodil grower in Tyrone called Esker Farm Daffodils. And David and Jules there, they have just the most amazing collection of daffodils. I mean, you do your heart good. And I think they've got some of the Brian Duncan varieties as well. And, oh, you should just see the
can I mean, you visit?
Yes, I think I saw it on their website that they welcome you to visit while the daffodil fields are in bloom. And then obviously you order and they deliver in the autumn. But generally they are at like a lot of the plant fairs and things like that. But they're definitely worth checking out, you know.
And look what I see, some other daffs there. Oh, that's beautiful, the Bridal Crown, I have to say, when you get close to it there and see it. Isn't it gorgeous?
Have a smell.
Oh, my God, give me that again.
Isn't that
amazing? The fragrance of that.
Isn't it just beautiful?
You'd never think, would you?
Yeah, and three flowers on one stem.
Yeah.
Isn't it just beautiful?
And that is, again, just remind us.
That's Bridal Crown, it's called.
Wow.
And it's commonly available.
Is it?
Thalia is just coming out. What I love about Thalia is, again, like there's, say, like there's two flowers on each stem, or two or three flowers on each stem. But look at the way even the unopened bud is so pretty.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah.
And then look, if I can just get in here to show you the lovely colour.
Oh,
isn't it just lovely?
It's such a delicate. And look at the centre, in at the centre there.
It's
the little
beautiful.
Yellowy green as well.
Absolutely.
It's truly beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So now we're
this
going
is just
here,
lovely. Up the hill we go. We're on good fettle.
Sure
we don't need to take too many breaths. It's lovely, though. But I can feel it. I say it here today, besides the daffodils. Look at the pink colours here.
Yeah.
Oh, isn't that just beautiful? What is that?
That is a dwarf cherry tree. It's called Prunus kojonomai, which is a bit of a mouthful. But it's one of my favourites because it doesn't get too big. Because even though we have room for cherry trees, I just like that the flowers are at eye level. It'll get to about 8 feet, I think, probably eventually, maybe 3 metres, you know. So, but that's, look at the bee.
Look at the big bumble in there. And you know, you're right, that little burst of sunshine, even though it's on the cool side, the bees are out there working away. Great to
see. They sure are.
And here more daffs as we walk by here. Beautiful again, aren't they?
Yeah. And it's funny because, remember I was saying, like, see, that's the tete-a-tetes from last year. So they're taller than the ones in pots and they're almost going over because I was in a bit of a panic. I was saying, oh, Jenny, what are we going to have now? Because we're too early for some and we're too late for others. But anyway, I can tell you where we are going to have them. Like, for example, up here, there's a semicircle. See the semicircle?
Yes.
So that's hydrangea limelight, but they're underplanted with Narcissus cheerfulness. And it's a gorgeous, gorgeous flower. This is just lovely in the wet ditch. This is a lovely thing. This is marsh marigold. And
beautiful.
Isn't it gorgeous?
Oh my, yeah. It's lovely.
And it loves having its feet wet, so that's very,
it's
very happy.
Perfect. It's thriving there down along where the little stream flows down to the lower part. And look at all the daffs. You have to go around here again and have a look at them.
But there's more daffodils there. I squeeze in bulbs. I'm a great believer in underplanting. And but isn't this lovely? I must get more of these, in fact. This is called the hoop petticoat daffodil, and it's tiny. That's really good for naturalizing in grass as well.
Yeah.
So because the foliage is grass-like, so that would kind of just, you know, blend in as it fades away. And then this is just again tete-a-tete. This is almost gone over. That was a kind of a tazetta daffodil with a lovely little orange center. Yeah. I know very little.
How many varieties have you?
Probably not that many. Probably only about 10 or 12. Because I've just stuck to the same ones because, like any obsession, like I'm bad enough with the hellebores and the snowdrops, I can't start another collection.
Asha, why not? But you have a great collection. You have, look at these again. Yeah. Oh, I have to say, being with you today, you know, the snowdrops are, in my opinion, welcome in the year, and they're gorgeous, and they have been gorgeous, and they're all gone as I come back. But the daffodil follows through from white to yellow, and it really is the harbinger of spring, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And, you know, they're so cheerful. But you don't have to be limited to yellow and to just the tall varieties. There's so many different varieties, you know, check them out. And then they bring you nicely into tulip season.
Yeah. It's been a real pleasure to visit your gardens again. Thank you so much for taking us round, focusing on daffodils for sure, but lots more happening in the garden. I'll see you soon.
You certainly will.
Taylor Swift, Cruel Summer. I hope she's wrong. We need a really good summer, not a cruel summer this year after all the blinking bad weather we've had to put up with. Anyway, roll it there, will you, Louise? Let's reprise our TV theme. Oh, it sounds spooky, but it's not really. Midsummer Murders. Do you ever watch it, Louise? Midsummer Murders. Yes, that is the TV show that music is.
I used to watch it all the time.
Yes, big following it has. Anyway, thanks to everybody who got it right, and there were loads. Anyway, our prize today goes to Bridie Clark. Well done, Bridie. Gift on its way to you as we speak.
You're looking a bit disappointed there, Jerry. Did you hear the news?
Oh,
you sitting there with the martini and an olive every day.
What would I be disappointed about?
Well, it looks like the Bond job is gone, I'm afraid.
Oh.
Yeah,
no.
007. Yeah.
Do you know what I, do you know how I feel about that, Louise?
Go on.
I'm shaken but not stirred. I couldn't resist. I'm shaken but not stirred. Yeah, good luck. Who's rumored? Who is it? Aaron
Taylor Johnson.
Is rumored to have been offered it,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It looks set. It kind of looks like they've done it.
Is he famous?
Yeah, he was in a lot of films. He was in a John Lennon film.
Right.
And he was in Superman Kick-Ass, and he was it's called his kind of a Superman kind of take on it. And he was in an Avengers, he was in Godzilla. Yeah. He was in quite a lot of films, yeah.
He's not on my radar, I have to be honest. But I'll tell you one thing, as 007, he's going to kick ass. Maybe that's why he got the job, having appeared in Superman Kick Ass. You wouldn't know. But there you go. Idris Elba was mentioned as
there's
a
load of
them
mentioned, and I've never heard him's name until now.
Yeah, well, there you go. So it's rumoured that he is actually going to be offered the next Bond role. So there you go. After Daniel Craig, who was marvellous.
Oh, yeah, I liked
him. Absolutely marvellous. Has to be rated among the greatest Bonds of all time, to be honest with you.
So there you go. You don't have to answer to Emma now.
No. And what about the man? You see that story today? The man who had a kidney transplant.
No.
He received a pig's kidney.
Oh.
Yeah, and he's doing well. He's doing well, yeah. They've transplanted a pig's kidney into a man. You're laughing there.
I was just going to say, you're telling the porky.
I'm not. What are you saying? I'm not telling the porky. But you know what? I'd say every time he goes to the toilet now, he'd be yearning for a rasher. Anyway, Late Lunch, LMFM Radio after 3. David Sheehan and Sport, my artist of the week. Stay with us.
We'll be baking after 3.
Absolutely.
The Late Lunch. The Late Lunch, Artist of the Week.
Artist of the Week.
Linda Ronstadt, it is all week my artist of the week. And on a personal level, Linda's private life became very public in the mid-1970s. You see, she had a relationship with then-governor of California, Jerry Brown, who also became the Democratic Party presidential candidate. In the 80s, did you know this, she dated actor Jim Carrey for a time before becoming engaged to George Lucas of Star Wars fame. That lasted 5 years before, now on her own, she adopted a baby girl called Mary Clementine in 1990. And then in 1994, she adopted a second child, a boy named Carlos. She never married and lives between San Francisco and her hometown, Tucson, Arizona. She's never been shy politically either, calling out both the Republican and Democrat parties and their various presidents for failings on a range of issues, especially wars and immigration. To conclude with the music of Linda Ronstadt today, I play my favourite Linda Ronstadt song. And indeed, it is regarded as her signature tune. It was written and recorded by Roy Orbison in 1963. It was a big hit for him, but an even bigger hit for her in 1977. Close your eyes, let your thoughts drift as we enjoy the Blue Bayou.
I feel so bad, I got a worried mind. I'm so lonesome all the time. Since I left my baby behind on Blue Bayou, saving nickels, saving dimes, working till the sun don't shine, looking forward to happier times on Blue Bayou. I'm going back someday, come what may, to Blue Bayou, where the fox are fine and the world is mine on Blue Bayou, where those fishing boats with their sails afloat. If I could only see that familiar sunrise through sleepy eyes, how happy I'd be.
One of our loveliest songs, Blue Bayou by Linda Ronstadt, rounding off my week of Linda on Your Late Lunch. And we'll bring in new artist or artist of the week on the show next week. Now, just reminding you, our LMFM Radio Bingo jackpot is €7,800. And if you get a book, you're in and you're playing in the bingo. And there's €1,000 lucky number draw happening on Monday, the 8th of April. Books available from outlets across the Northeast. If you're not in, you cannot win. Late Lunch, LMFM Radio, final break of the day on the show. And coming up is our regular look ahead to the weekend in sport with David Sheehan. GAA and soccer to be previewed over the next while on Late Lunch with David Sheehan. Afternoon, David.
Afternoon, Kerry.
Thanks for joining me again. Well, the final weekend of the National League and all to play for, really, especially in the context of Louth. Both games on tomorrow at 7 o'clock. Kildare face Louth and Carlow at 7 tomorrow evening. And I know you're in Donegal, Ballybuffet for Donegal against Meath, also at 7 o'clock. Let's talk about Louth. What a riot they ran against Fermanagh last year. I couldn't believe the goals going in. It was like raining goals for Louth. Anyway, they've given themselves the opportunity of staying up. It's in their own hands. If they beat Kildare, they're safe.
Yeah, probably more goals in RD last week than we've seen in Weavers Park and Oriel Park so far this season combined, Gerry. Yeah, incredible, incredible stuff. And no one really could have seen that coming because, Fermanagh are usually a doughty enough team and hard to break down, hard to beat. But, I think four goals went in the first half. I was in Navan myself and I was keeping an eye on the scoreline there. So that was a huge result for Louth. And to be fair, we said it last week, they were in, they say the table never lies, but they were in a little bit of a false position. They played well in a lot of their matches and come out on the wrong side of one or two point defeats. So I think they were due that result last week, albeit the kind of emphatic nature of it was unexpected. But they go into the game against Kildare tomorrow. Kildare already relegated, as we know. And Louth, basically, I'm seeing that it's being pitched as a must-win game for Leith. It's not a must-win for them. It's a must-win or a must-draw. Mm. And even if they lose, they need Fermanagh to beat Cavan. A draw against Cavan for Fermanagh is no good. So Louth need to lose and Fermanagh need to win for Louth to get relegated. And, you know, they had the bit between their teeth after that game last week. Their destiny's in their own hands. They've been pretty decent in this league campaign in spite of the position they find themselves in. And I think that they'll go down to Carlow as is. Don't go down to Newbridge, Louth supporters. It's down in Carlow. So yeah, I'd expect them to get the win down there and take care of business. It's not like it'd take a miracle for them to be relegated, but it's not a million miles away from that the way that both teams are going. Fermanagh have to recover from that absolute hammering last week. Cavan are a decent side, so even Fermanagh getting the win would be a bit of a shock. And I think Louth will be okay. I think they'll go down to Kildare or down to Carlow and do their stuff down there and get the win and take it out of all doubt. And I think it's only right as well, because I think they've had a pretty good campaign, and Gerard Brennan has come in and has kind of kept things going, and I'd expect them to get that result themselves tomorrow and not have to worry about anything else.
Now, you're in Ballybuffet for Donegal against Meath. It's a dead rubber, really. Donegal are where they are, level on points, top with Armagh. Meath are safe in the middle of the table. But you'd have to say, to gauge where Meath are performance-wise against a decent Donegal side, this is an important game for Meath.
Yeah, it is. I was checking earlier to see if Donegal had named a team, and I couldn't see anything. They may have named it just a short time ago, or maybe they'll do it later today. Meath have named their team, as we know, and they've kind of rung the changes. Harry O'Higgins is back in. It's his first appearance in the league. Adam McDonald starts. He's had a few appearances off the bench, and Keith Curtis starts as well. So Colm O'Rourke has given a few of his kind of substitutes on the wider panel a bit of a run. But as you said, Gerry, I mean, it's a dead rubber insofar as Donegal are already through to the final and Meath are already safe. But Meath are out in the championship in a couple of weeks' time on the 7th of April, I think it is, against Longford. So this is an ideal kind of preparation for them in terms of coming up against a good side. I know they've made a few changes, but Colm O'Rourke will be looking to see what his wider squad can add to it. Keith Curtis had a great year with Rathkenny and within the club, in the club scene in Meath, and then also in the run they had in Leinster. So he'll be looking to come in and prove a point. And as I said, that game against Longford is only a couple of weeks away. So this is another tune-up for that game. And, you know, Donegal, again, as we said, we don't know what sort of a team they put out. They'll presumably put out a bit of a mix and match as well with that league final on the horizon. But it's definitely an important one for me in terms of going into the championship with a bit of confidence and a bit of form. That game against Cork last week will have really knocked them after a couple of good performances. Good wins against Louth and Kildare. A draw against Cavan with a good performance that night. Then last week, to be leading by 3 points with about 15 minutes to go and then just completely fade out of the game, concede 7 points on the spin. That'd be a real dent to the confidence. So I think they'll be looking to go out tomorrow night. And like Louth went up to Donegal and gave them a right run for their money. It was a bit of an unfortunate goal that kind of put paid to Louth on that occasion. So me, they'd want to be going up there and giving a good account of themselves. You don't want to be going into the championship off the back of a hammering in your final league game, because you don't have a lot of time to turn it around. And, you know, the morale can take a bit of a dent in training, everything else. So it's important for me to go up there and put in a performance. Probably difficult to call that they'd get a win, depending on what team Donegal put out. But certainly, it'll be important for them to put in a performance and for those players who are getting a chance to grab it with both hands.
Now, Ladies National Football League, final round of games there as well. Meath have nothing to play for. They play Cork on Sunday in Division 1 in Navan. It's been a disappointing campaign. Started so well, has petered out, really. And Louth in Division 3, they're in Sligo. Sligo, the bottom team in that division. Louth needs something from that as well, like the men, don't they, to stay up?
Yeah, they do. They need to avoid defeat in that game. Antrim are playing Roscommon. So for people who aren't aware, Louth are third from bottom on 4 points. Antrim are on 3 points. And then Sligo are on 1 point. So this game between Louth and Sligo is essentially a bit of a shootout here. Antrim are playing against Roscommon. And Roscommon are top. And you'd expect them to win that game, all things being equal, unless they rest a load of players. But yeah, this game against Sligo is a bit of a shootout for Louth. You know, they have 4 points. Sligo only have 1 point from their campaign. Really, Louth should be going in there a bit like the men. They should be going down there and taking care of their part of the bargain and not having to worry about other results going for them. So I think they will. I think they'll go down there and get the win and secure their status for next year. And then I suppose the Meath game, as you said, Meath have had a bit of a disappointing campaign after a really good start. Well beaten against Kerry last week. Beaten by Galway, beaten by Armagh, but they're safe in that division. Cork, though, they're bottom and they've the worst points difference as well. They need a win. And this is a Cork team, of course, who have a lot of history. I know not necessarily this team themselves, but Cork in ladies football going back through the years would have been one of the kingpins. So for them to get relegated would be a bit of a disaster. They need to beat Meath and they need a bit of a favour in the Galway and Waterford matches. They need those two sides to drop points. So it's not looking great for Cork. Meath will just want to finish with a bit of a flourish and go into the championship again a little bit like the men as well, with a little bit of confidence after, as you said, a great start and just kind of petered out for them.
Let's switch to soccer. League of Ireland this week. No Premier League either, with the international scene taking precedent. Ireland, under John O'Shea's stewardship, with Brian Kerr by his side, they play Belgium tomorrow at 5 o'clock in the Aviva Stadium, and then they take on Switzerland Tuesday at 7:45. I want to ask you something. Are you hearing that the Georgia manager will be the next Irish manager, Willie Sanyol?
Willie Sanyol, Jerry, look, it'd be easier to write down the managers that haven't been linked with this job at this point. You know, there's been so many different names mentioned. Gus Poyet, Sanyol, I saw the former Sweden manager was mentioned this morning by John Fallon in the Irish Examiner. It's really hard to know. And I mean, what happens if John O'Shea sends out a team and puts in two really good performances? Yes. And what happens then? So maybe the FAI can spin it that the contract that they were waiting to expire was John O'Shea's caretaker contract, and now he's got a full time contract with them. Nothing would surprise me, you know. So I don't know. It's been such a kind of a farcical process. Lee Carsley rule himself out during the week, claims that only had one conversation with them a good few months back. I don't know if that's 100% true. Maybe he's just plumassing the FA there a little bit. But look, in terms of the games this weekend, I think a few interesting things to look out for. What keeper is he going to go with? I presume he'll give Bazuno and Kelleher one game each. I think Sammy Schmodics, we're all looking forward to seeing him.
Yeah.
It's been a long time coming. There was a lot of talk about maybe he was going to declare for Hungary. He said during the week that that was never an option and he was always committed to Ireland. Like, top scorer, I think, in the championship, and has been really impressive for Blackburn Rovers, and a fairly mediocre, struggling Blackburn Rovers team, really. So the only pity is that he's 28. So we're a bit late getting to him. But look, I'll be really interested to see how he does if he starts, and just in terms of what formation they play, who might come in and do well and put their hand up. So yeah, it's an interesting one, but has John O'Shea got any chance of getting this job? The FAI would have you believe he doesn't, but I wouldn't rule him out of it either. So I'm going to be really interested to see how these two games go, how they perform, and what happens. I wonder if the FAI are maybe hoping that they tank in these two matches so there's no clamour for John O'Shea to get the job. Who knows, Jerry? It's like a soap opera.
It is. I was going to say that it's better than Coronation Street, EastEnders or anything. The FAI, the gift that keeps on giving. You just can't beat it, for sure. Anyway, David, we leave it there today. Good luck in Ballybuffet tomorrow night. Thanks for joining me, Jerry. On the show. Take care. Bye-bye. That's our man David Sheehan there, looking ahead to the weekend in sport. Oh my God. Pantomime comes to mind when I think of the FAI. Anyway, let's close the shop for this week and say a big thank you to our guests who've joined us on the show each day. To your listeners who are with us, we love your company. To my producer Louise Walsh, couldn't do this without her. Thanks a million, Louise. Eddie Caffrey's on his way with The Drive here on LMFM Radio. Stay with us for wonderful music and more besides. And we're back with Late Lunch. Brand new week of Late Lunch, Monday, 1:30. Have a lovely weekend. Take care of yourselves and we'll see you then.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.